You're listening to the Focus on Women podcast, where our mission is to elevate female-identifying creatives in the commercial photography industry.
We talk with all types of creatives, from producers, art directors, creative directors, to photographers, agents, and stylists. We dig into how they got to where they are today.
I'm Shelley Waldman, a commercial and editorial photographer focusing on food and lifestyle, living between London and California.
And I'm Lauren Hubbard, a commercial and editorial food lifestyle photographer based in Atlanta, Georgia.
And we're going to dig into this next episode.
Let's do it.
So I got caught in a hailstorm, totally unprepared. And everyone keeps asking me lately, like, are you used to the weather in London? And I keep saying yes, because I lived in the Bay Area where it was cold and foggy. And but I'm not prepared for like pebble size hail that rains down on you for like 20 minutes. Yeah, that I was not prepared for. That was insane.
When you sent me that video, I was like, wait, what is that? Is it snow? Yeah. Or is it hail? Like, that's wild to me. So that was, sounds like you're having an interesting week, Shelley.
Where in the Bay Area are you from?
I used to live in, or I, whatever, cohabitate in Richmond, just north of Berkeley.
Okay. I know approximately where that is. My husband's from Foster City.
Okay, so that's south on the peninsula side, the southwest. I'm north of Oakland. I'm on the Oakland side. But yeah, it's very, I mean, I was used to the fog and like the chilliness and the wind, but like London is a bit crazy at the moment. It kind of reminds me of growing up in Southern California with the Santa Ana winds, because the last 3 days have been crazy winds, like howling outside my window, where I'm like, what is going on outside? Like, is there an animal out there? But no, just the wind.
Just global warming. It's fine.
That's it's so just good. Very bizarre.
My goodness. It's getting nice here in Georgia. It's like trying to be spring. I guess it's a normal thing in spring where it's like cold in the morning, and then as the day goes on, it's nice. So we're finally getting things blooming, and one of my favorite times of year here. So I'm super excited. I am also super excited because our listeners, our third mystery voice here is another Lauren. We have two Laurens on today. I'm so excited.
Just to keep y'all confused.
I know, right? It's I feel like that was a perfect way to start it, with just you coming in and then be like, and not only is this another voice, but it's another Lauren. Lauren Volo, thank you for being here with us today. We're so excited to have you on the podcast.
Oh, thank you guys for having me.
Can you give us a quick, like, give us your quick spiel? You're in line to get coffee or tea. Coffee or tea?
Oh, coffee.
Nice.
I mean, if I'm drinking tea, you know that I've been sick for a while and I've succumbed and given in.
Things are bad if I'm drinking tea.
Things are really bad if I'm drinking tea.
Okay, so coffee. So you're in the coffee line and someone's like, oh, what do you do? What's your answer?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those fun things, because now I feel like people know more about food photography because of social media and access. But if you had told somebody 10 years ago, like, oh, you're a food and lifestyle photographer, they'd be like, oh, so you like cook food and like use hairspray? I'm sure we've all heard this before.
Motor oil.
Yeah, no, nope, that's not it at all. So it's evolved a lot, but it's really fun because now I can tell people about like more specifically what I do with food photography. It's not just like, I'm a food photographer, I take pictures of burgers. No, like I can talk about the kind of work that I like to do, which I would say a good percentage of what I've been working on the last few years has been cookbooks. And I've been really lucky to get to work on these like little micro capsule projects for 5 or 10 days and really get to like live with your team and live with these authors and get little pockets and snippets of people's lives. And so it's fun to talk to people about that, because that's more relatable than just talking about the technical aspect of what we do.
I love that so much. And I have to say, I've geeked out about your work, because I love cookbook photography. I love cookbooks for the photography, really. Like I really don't cook very much, but I am a food photographer. Yeah. And I just love, like, cookbooks is one of the first like food imagery things I just fell in love with. Like, they're just so beautiful. They're this like story about like a food and like food and a person all rolled up into one. And I love it. So I'm really excited to dive into your world.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's the heart of it, right? Is like, it's not just about food and nutrition. Sometimes it is, but a lot of the time it's about the story that's behind what you're taking the picture of. And so, you know, getting to start at the beginning and hearing what people have the vision of doing and translating that into something tangible is very rewarding.
I love it. So before we keep going too much on that, we're always curious, like how you got here, right? So when you were a kid, were you like running around with a camera? Were you super creative and artsy? What were you like?
Well, when I was 12, my uncle gave me his old Minolta. And I futzed around with that for a while, like taking really bad pictures, not having any idea what I was doing. And then when I got to high school, we had, I'm from a rural part of Connecticut that, you know, everyone goes to the same school. So it's not like you have a choice of, if you're from New York City and you have children, it's like mind-blowing how you have to deal with education in the system. But that's a story for another time. In Connecticut, y'all go to the same school, and we had this great chorus teacher who also was like, I'm going to start in photography club. And he turned our janitor's closet into a dark room, and like five of us art nerds practiced doing photography with the film canisters and processing negatives and the whole thing. And I got a little bit better, but ultimately I had, you know, it always comes down to that one teacher who was like, you should consider doing art. And I had always been so intimidated by the prospect of that. I had an older sister who's an incredible artist, like painter, you know, with the perfect penmanship, and everything was very obvious. She was the artist. And I was like, I have chicken scratch. Like there's nothing really that creative about me. It's like, no, I think that you should push this. So by the time I was a senior in high school, I'd manipulated my schedule. So I had like AP art, photography, English and history. Like there was no science, there was no math. I went to art school and I was just like, I'm going to do photography. My mom was like, how about you consider doing architecture? In retrospect, maybe sometimes I'm like, that maybe could have been an easier path, but I don't think it would have been satisfying. So I went to art school within a university setting. That was the compromise. Like, so I went to Syracuse and I just got lucky because the department there was only in their second year, but they have since built a really reputable art program out of Syracuse. The thing that is crazy, and anyone who is going to college for photography, I'm sure has come across, is that they like to peg you into being one thing or another. And it's still something I struggle with today, where they want you to be the journalism photographer, like the commercial photographer, or you're an artist. And they don't really cross. And so at Syracuse, I was in the School of Visual and Performing Arts. And if I wanted to take any of the journalism or commercial photography classes, I essentially would have had to stay another year. And they were already taking so much of my money to take the math and science and the foundation classes. So I just kept taking their classes without getting the official double major title, if you will.
Okay.
So I could use their equipment and have access to their teachers and all that. So it was a lot of extra work from the beginning, but I kind of knew from a very early age that this was what I was going to do. And it just got frustrating at times because I'm like, this isn't technical enough. How am I going to run a business with this information?
Oh, good. It's good that you at least sort of knew that you were missing that, because what's so hard about the major lack of business education and art programs is that a lot of students don't realize that they need it.
You know? I mean, if I was really that ambitious, I would have taken the business class, but that was in an entirely different college and like a whole other hurdle, you know, like everything was just not obvious. That's the thing about going to big university, is that you have to go through all these hoops, as opposed to a small liberal arts where maybe everything is a little more consolidated. But I came out of the gate and moved home for like a month before I started working in the city for like a job I found off of Craigslist, because you know that's how we all got started.
It really is. It was for me too.
Man, I did production for this producer who wouldn't call himself a producer because he was trying to mark himself as something different than what existed. But it was a fun intro because they were doing like high-end hair portrait shoots for like Redken at Pier 59. And when you're 22 and have stars in your eyes about what this industry is, you're like, yes, I'm doing it. And you're like, oh no, I'm making $12 an hour. And
fetching coffee.
Yeah, and getting so much coffee. I think I took lunch orders for like 10 years.
But what was that role? I mean, besides running around and being the gopher, you know, what did that expose you to that you didn't already know?
I think that was an important intro to production and the way things worked. I mean, back then it was all like we would get a slew of portfolios in from photographers, and then we would submit them to different advertising agencies to look at for their jobs and pitch their jobs and give them estimates. And, you know, it was kind of like a weird go-between company. But I think I had a cold call a bunch of people. I had to update all the contacts. I got to see who were the people that were working. I was looking through their portfolios. I got to see the kind of work that was getting work. It was very gatekept at that time. It was very much a man's business. And, you know, at times it still feels that way, but it has definitely grown and changed in a lot of ways for the better since then. I only did that for about a year before I found another internship on Craigslist working for a food photographer in Hell's Kitchen. And I was only there one day a week. And it was fine. You know, I was getting to be the photo assistant. The way that they were running the studio is you got to be the photo assistant for the photo shoot if it was scheduled that day, so if you were the intern. So that's where I really got to cut my teeth in. Everything was film. So learning how to load medium format cameras. Like, obviously I knew how to do 35mm, but back then everyone was shooting food with medium format. And then working with the labs, that's where I started learning how to have the relationships with all the labs. And you would send the chromes out to get processed and come back and then scan everything into Photoshop. And it was a much slower process, but still you got to learn how to bracket and see composition. And that was, you know, about a summer. And then they were going to be hiring a full-time assistant, and it wasn't going to be me. But one day the other assistant didn't show up, so I got the job by default. And then I ended up working with that photographer for 8 years as their.
Oh, wow.
So, and that's a unique thing, because I don't think that many photographers really took anyone on as like a staff assistant. But I really just was thrown in the deep end of like, all right, now you're the assistant, now you're the manager, now you're the travel agent. And
so you were running the studio as well as being the photo assistant.
For a little bit. And then ultimately they sold their studio because they wanted to buy a house in the city. So they used the collateral from the studio to buy a house. So it was a lot of travel back then. And it was great. It was, you know, I feel like I, in my 20s, got to see so much, and I'm very grateful for that. And I don't feel like I need to go be that person that hasn't seen the world anymore. I love to travel when I do travel, but it's not like I haven't seen the world. I'm like, no, I got to see a good amount of the world. I'm good with it. And when it happens, I like really can pick and choose what it is.
That's awesome. And I think what's so great about like interning or being the assistant, being the person that like a photographer can just offload all of the things they don't want to do anymore or deal with, is that is all the really core business stuff you need to learn, like all of that grindy stuff that helps you really like get yourself up and running. So it's like exactly the education you need, but you get to, you know, be plopped into somebody else's world that already has a business up and running. I think that's awesome.
Yeah. And also, you know, it was all these reoccurring relationships. Like, that photographer was doing a lot of cookbooks. And so not very many of the same people who were at the publishing houses are still there, but like the really green people that were around my generation that were coming up are the ones that gave me my first opportunities when I was finally getting started. But I did have to quit that job so I could get my shit together, because I was traveling so much. I couldn't shoot any of my own stuff. Like there were no weekends. There was no life. There was just only work, which when you're in your 20s is fine, especially when you're doing what you want to be doing. But I took a studio managing job for a year just so I could have like a 9 to 5 and get my stuff going. And then after a year, I think I lined up like 10 weddings in a row and quit that job, and then haven't looked back.
What was the point at which I feel like we kind of, it was such a seamless thing that I didn't quite catch it. So maybe I missed it, but like, what was it that like, is this job what got you really interested in food, or were you already really excited about, you know, the world of food photography?
You know, food is kind of a funny thing. It found me at a young age. I started working under the table at a 5-star Relais Chateau hotel and inn when I was 15. And so I was introduced to fancy food from a very young age. And I worked there, you know, all through high school, every single weekend, and through college breaks when I would go home, and eventually I was like the nanny for the manager, like the whole thing. And so I had this respect for food and chefs and that culture from a really young age. And also that is a place where I love having assistants that have restaurant backgrounds, because they know how to hustle and they know how to work hard. And that really matters to me. But the, you know, I kind of, when I was in school, really felt like I needed to learn how to work with people more. So I never really did any food photography when I was learning how to shoot. But coincidentally, the photographer, when I started working the city, was a food photographer. He had a fashion background, but primarily food was what I was learning how to work with from him. And I think that even he was surprised that I eventually went on to shoot food, but I didn't find it surprising at all. It's like, well, no, because you get to incorporate working with people and not models, like real people, which is what I'm interested in shooting. The fashion world, my takeaway from doing that 1 year in production, all the Pier 59 and all that shoots, is like, I didn't gravitate towards all of the stigmas that were affiliated with the high fashion world. There was just like so much, it felt like a dog and pony show. Like there's some fashion photographers that do incredible work and I love what they're doing and I find it so inspiring. But if I had to be the person that was running that show, I would run it so differently. And I don't think that it would be taken seriously.
Well, I think what's interesting is between your, you know, the high fashion, you know, where you were, you know, just talking about, as well as like working as an assistant for 8 years, it's almost like you got hands-on MFA, right? Like you got a hands-on MFA and a hands-on MBA at the same time. And that's really where like a lot of those business skills, just from the repetitiveness of doing a lot of that work, probably came in. And you snuck in there that you went from working in a studio to being a studio manager to shooting weddings. And so like, let's talk about this pivot period, right? Where you are 8 years in and you're thinking about like, okay, well, I'm guessing you're like, okay, how do I untether from this like world so you could start doing your own thing? Like when did those thoughts start creeping in to having you say like, okay, how am I going to make that transition out for whatever it is that you visioned for yourself?
I mean, if you talk about that, then you have to start talking about like how you're living and existing in New York. And I think that even where the industry is at, and again, and in tandem to like where you kind of fall in the social tier, because I was self-supporting myself from the beginning. I didn't have anyone like lifting me up in any kind of financial way. So for me, it's always like, all right, every Friday I would sit down and do my budget and figure out I need to make X amount of money for the week to get by. And so I lived at that point, because the way I moved to the city is I was a live-in nanny. So I wasn't getting paid, but I had free room and board. And that was when I was doing my internship, because the kid was in school during the day. So I could work while she was in school. And then when I took the assisting job, I had to leave. And I moved in with these two dudes from Craigslist again. And, you know, I knew I had to make X amount of money to pay my rent. And then somebody's like, oh, I'm leaving the city. Do you want my rent controlled apartment in the East Village with the bathtub in the kitchen? And I'm like, yes, I do. And I moved to the East Village for a while and I did that. And I think that was kind of a scary thing, even though it was a cheap apartment, I could barely afford it. And so I was like, well, I know I need to, I think at the time, like, I know I need to make $1,600 a month to pay my bills and my rent, which I look back on, I'm like, oh my God, I wish. So doing weddings, I could afford to do a wedding for like $1,500 and pretty much pay my bills. If I did two weddings a month, I was, you know, taking everyone out to dinner. Like, it was, I was in a good place.
I'm the queen of New York.
Yeah. You know, I could stay out in the bar until 4 a.m. But it, yeah, those were fun years because the East Village was like the happening place to be back then.
Especially with a bathtub in your kitchen. I mean, man.
And I had two friends come and live with me for brief periods of time while I was there. It was a fun place. It was right above, I don't know if you guys know New York, but anyone who's listening, it was right above the rubber stamp shop, which is kind of like a New York institution, if run by an old Scottish guy who's great. He's still there. I stopped in there like a month ago after the AMA workshop and I was like, he's still here. Bought a stamp for my kid. Yeah, something's gonna change. But I don't know if that place is still rent controlled or getting bought or what the deal is. Yeah, but the weddings were kind of just a thing where I was at the age where everyone was getting married. And it started because someone was like, can you shoot my wedding? And you shoot, so if you know how to shoot properly, you can pretty much shoot anything, I would think. I believe that. And so I did one wedding and then somebody was like, you did a great job. Can you shoot my wedding? And so then all of a sudden it just kind of snowballed and I did a bunch. The thing that's tricky with only doing weddings off of recommendations is like one of the last weddings I did was just like really, really hard. And I just was like, nope, I'm done. I'm only going to do what I want to be doing. It was like a daytime wedding. Hardly anyone came. It was poor. It wasn't really decorated. Like it was so challenging. And I had been taught this MO from the photographer I worked with that like, you're only good as your last job. And I walked away from that, like, I am not good.
It
was a good humbling experience to have because that really motivated me to get my food portfolio together and to start testing with the other assistants that were trying to get going. And then it only took one or two people taking advantage of me being cheap to get the ball rolling.
Well, weddings are, I feel like Shelley and I have talked about this before, but weddings are such a great little microcosm of all kinds of photography rolled into one, with the additional pressure of like, there are no redos, there's no pause. It's just, you have to get as much as you can as the day goes on. And you know, yeah, it's a lot of pressure, but it, you get the food and you get the lifestyle and you get the portraits and, you know, and product, you get all these different things. So they're a great, like, learn and experiment tool. It's a long day, but it's a good day.
It's a long day. I mean, honestly, shooting the wedding, I think, is so much fun. The editing can be the toughest part. It's so many hours and I shoot way too much. I would take way too many pictures.
I'm with you. I understand what you mean. So at some point you're like, okay, so what happens then? You're like, I'm done. I'm backing away gracefully from weddings.
What then? I think someone gave me my first cookbook deal after that. It was right around that time. And I built up, it was around when it was like slow cookers and Instant Pots and like all these, you know, everyone needed those things shot all at once. And there was a hyperabundance because the top level photographers were like above doing that kind of work. So like all this low level assistants who knew these publishers and maintained relationships with them were kind of given a good lift. Like I would say there was maybe like 5 or 10 of us who had come up under, you know, Gentle and Hires, and there was like a certain, you know, there was a circle of those top tier level food photographers who worked with consistent assistants, and those publishers gave us all opportunities, and I feel very fortunate for their loyalty.
Did you know there is so much more to Focus on Women? We actually have a membership.
As a member, you have the opportunity to work with a mentor, highlight your work through our artist spotlight, partake in portfolio reviews, and best of all, keep the conversation going through our member-only Slack channel.
Hop on over to focusonwomen.org and sign up today to take advantage of all these benefits that will move you forward and support you on your journey.
Now, back to our show.
So then, okay, so you're getting your first opportunity to be the one in charge. You're shooting this cookbook.
Yeah.
Talk to us about what
I mean, it was, you start building relationships from that, because then you have the material, you have, and like all of a sudden you go from like 8 to 16 images you shot in a test with somebody to like 50 to 100 recipes, and you can pick your favorite or use all of them for your website, depending on how much content you really need. And, you know, it was back then, the opportunities were like, can you cook? Can you style? And can you shoot this food for $500? And you're like, yes, I can. And I will never share those images. You will never see them. They will never find the light of day. But I did do that kind of work in the beginning, because, you know, you have to get the practice, you have to get the experience. People needed the content more slowly than they do now. Like, and then I've always been like a hobby dancer. I did dance for like my fitness, and I couldn't afford to go to the dance studios all the time, but the dance teachers at the studios also taught at Crunch Gym, and I had like a $50 Crunch Gym membership that I went to every day. And I built this community of dancers I was really good friends with. And one of them happened to be at an advertising agency that had a contract with Diageo. And so after like 2 years of really struggling to like survive off of cookbooks and a wedding here and there, I got a contract deal at Diageo with her, doing like bar.com, which was a website where they were just like trying to shoot all their cocktails and recipes. And they would have, you know, me come in for 1 or 2 days a month and into their bar and create a studio. And I would find out the day before which brands were coming downstairs, and they would bring props from their prop closet, and you'd have to make something from nothing. And sometimes it was great and sometimes it was bad, but they were so, you know, no one was, that content lived only on this website. There was no like Instagram really at that point. So I did that until Brexit happened, and then they like did mass layoffs. Yeah. But that was a couple of years of working for them. And that kind of, more cookbooks picked up, and then small advertising things came in, and the stylists I work with start working with other ad agencies, right? That's how it snowballs, and they start pulling you into those projects.
So let's talk about the networking piece of this and the relationship piece of all of this. Because I love that you touched on, you know, knowing assistants, especially when you were assisting yourself, and, you know, kind of maintaining those relationships. But as you started to grow and people started to move around, right, that always helps with any career. But how are you either finding new opportunities? Like you mentioned going to Crunch and just having to talk to like your group of friends that are at Crunch. Lauren, you know, Lauren Liz, like you'll love this, you know, it's very Marie Forleo with the Crunch membership.
Oh, yeah.
Crunch membership in New York, is she talks about that as well.
Oh, really?
That was a huge, yes, like networking thing for her.
I mean, I didn't know that I was doing myself just a favor. And I still love those people. I a lot of them have left the city, sadly, but.
But, you know, like, were you still doing cold outreach at this point? Like, were you marketing to people? Were you just trying to maintain the relationships you already had and kind of keep your head above water?
Yeah. You know, again, it was like, it feels almost like it doesn't apply the way that people have to go after work now in some ways, because initially the way that I even would try and work for other photographers was I would go to Barnes & Noble. I would take a stack of magazines. I would look up the gutters to see who was shooting, and I would cold email them and contact them. The same thing with the contents page to see like who's the managing editor, who's the art director, who's in the photo department. And I would cold email them. I would like try and find, I would Google like one email address and then try and plug in like a million other email addresses until like I got one. I mean, that really only worked for like the smaller editorial things like Brooklyn Magazine and Edible. And I did that for a while. That paid me like $200 a story. But it was good. You know, it was all very humbling. Like you had to be willing to pound the pavement. And I think back then I also had like a blog where I'd post one terrible picture a day, no matter what it was. No one was looking at it, but it was a good thing for me to look at from start to finish to see like where I had come from. I wish I still had it. It's gone. Can't access it anymore. I know, it's kind of a bummer.
It's like getting the reps
like a stat counter email that tells me what my stats are, but I can't seem to disable that email, but the website doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I mean, it's like getting your reps in and, you know, getting getting into shape for like the, you know, when you get called to the big stage.
Yeah, but then there's also things like Found, which still exists. And there, what's the other one that's really expensive?
Workbook.
Not Lookbook, not Found. What's the
like
other
Workbook one? Or Ad Edge?
Ad Edge. I felt so validated. Ad Edge finally invited me to participate. And I was like, great, let's do it. And they're like, that'll be $7,000. I'm like, no, thank you. Not going to do that today. Mad respect to the people too. And I really did use the images that were in those books for a lot of inspiration of how I could shoot things myself, especially early on. But now it's different because people have social media and like that immediacy of like they want to do something, they can look up a hashtag, or everyone credits everybody now on social media, which is great because now you can just go directly to that person and contact them if you want to work with them. We didn't get credit ever. There was no like, and a photo assistant on this list, unless an author wanted to give us something in the acknowledgement pages.
I'm curious at what point, because you are repped a big Leo. So how did that come about? And how did that, I guess, were you seeking being repped? I want to know how that came about and how you feel like that impacts you from a business standpoint.
Yeah, I would say so. I, you know, when I quit the studio managing job and when I left assisting, I was like, I, you know, have destroyed so many relationships. I want to date someone and not travel away for a year. And so I met my husband, which was
Yay.
Great. Yeah, it was great. And he was like, I think you need help. And I'm like, no, I got it. He's like, I really think you could benefit from having someone support you. I'm like, I'm good. And he's like, all right, I'm going to leave it for a year. And then he would come back to it. And at that point, there was like one particular winter where things were just getting out of hand. And I had known Mary and Willie from Big Leo because they repped one of my very good friends who was a stylist at the time. And so whenever I hired her, started a relationship with them, and they looked over my portfolio. If I had estimate questions off the record, they would kind of help me out once in a blue moon. So I had like a early working relationship with them. But when I started considering having an agent after the second or third year, my husband bugged me about it. I was like, okay, well, let's see. I don't even know what agencies are in the game at this point. And I don't want to, I'd had, you know, from the photographers I'd worked for, heard such harrowing things of like, oh, they take your cut and they don't do anything and you're a pawn. And I'm like, I don't think that's true, because I know that some people have had good experiences. I just need to like talk to some people. So I had heard from Kimberly, and I didn't know that she was over with Big Leo, because I had an email correspondence with her when she was at her old agency, back when I used to work for my old photographer. So I'm like, I know this name. How do I know this name? And she's like, no, I'm working with Mary. I'm at Big Leo, and now I'm an agent. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting. So she kind of sought me out, and we just clicked, and it was kind of really easy. And I didn't even do that much research into other agencies after that, because it felt like a natural way to move forward. But the hilarious thing is, like, I think we finally went to go onboard me, and I found out a week later I was pregnant with my second kid. And I'm like, they're not going to want me anymore. I'm like, someone posted the other day, like, hire pregnant women. I'm like, no one wants a pregnant woman because they don't know how long they're going to take off or if they're ever coming back. And there's so many stigmas around being a working parent. So I was like, I hate to tell you this, but I'm going to be having a baby, and I'm going to take a couple months off to do that. But like, I really still want to keep working with you. And then I was bracing myself that they're like, okay, we're not going to go forward. And she's like, I'm having a baby too.
Yay.
So yeah, we thought it was like great timing, because we were both going to be not working around the same time. Her daughter is only like 4 months older than Kit. And the joke was on us, because then COVID hit and no one worked.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
I totally understand that fear, though. I mean, when my son is going to be 15 this summer. But when I was pregnant with him, I got this opportunity to like via Craigslist, found this photographer who was looking for an assistant and like assistant slash studio manager. And I was 4 months pregnant. So I was like, can't totally tell. I could get away with like, and I was young, so like couldn't really tell. But I reached out, was like, hey, I'd be interested in you meeting with me. He's like, well, I have an engagement shoot today. Can you be there to help? And I was like, yes. And like not mentioning anything. So I meet him, we go through the shoot. It goes great. That was like my interview, was basically assisting on this shoot to see how I did. And he was like, yeah, you were really great. You anticipated all these things, like blah, blah. He was like, but I have to say, and he's like, please forgive me if you're not, but are you pregnant? And I was like, why would, you know, I was just like weird because I didn't feel like you could tell. I mean, 4 months.
Never asked that today.
I know. I couldn't believe he asked. But I guess he could tell because I guess I was being a little bit careful because I had lost a baby before that. So I was a little bit nervous about stuff. And so I was kind of being here. And I was like, yes, I am. I'm sorry. Is that okay? And he was like, yeah, I could just tell by some of the ways you're moving. Cause he had a little girl. And so he could kind of tell in the way that I was moving, I guess, which was weird, but we ended up working together for years. So it was fine. But I understand that like nobody's going to want to work with me. Cause I'm like going to have a baby. So I'm glad it worked out for you too.
Yeah, no, it did. It was, I mean, I just have also naturally kind of gravitated towards all female crews. Because I worked with only men in the industry for so long. I was like, I'm going to run this a little bit differently. And I don't think that I was intentional when I was getting started. But then after a while, I was like, no, I really like supporting people that, you know, haven't had opportunities. So it's been a juggle for sure. I was also very lucky after I had my first son, I got a part-time contract at the kitchen. That was, you know, having just like a little bit of stability going back to work after having a baby, but not having to like take on that role full time was such a lucky thing for your mind, for like your new mama mind. That's like, what is happening? I don't sleep anymore. So it was good. And the silver lining about COVID is that we had been preparing to have me not work for 2 or 3 months. And so it wasn't like we were suddenly caught out. And then we took full advantage of all the government funding that we could get our hands on.
Right. Yeah. You just ended up getting a little bit longer off than you anticipated.
Yeah. It's changed though. I would say the industry is still kind of feeling the ripple effect of COVID.
I feel like expectations got higher in a way of like things that, you know, it's like, oh, you're like, now we know we can all be super flexible about things. So let's keep doing it. And let's keep working with as few people as possible. Like, not necessarily. We like to have our people. Like, we want them back.
I know. I don't ever really have a full-time assistant on a cookbook shoot anymore.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah, no, that's something that kind of phased out during COVID and hasn't come back budget-wise. You don't really, depending on the level of the photo shoot, you don't really need to have somebody there the whole time, but I'm not the best with file naming if you really are getting wrapped up and absorbed in what you're doing. And so then at the end of the day, when you have to go back through and you're like, what was this? And you're screenshotting it and you're sending it to the food stylist and sorry.
You're like, what was the name of that green again?
Right. Well, and so I want to take it back to that transition into working with Big Leo then, because you had been hesitant for a while and like, do I need help? And so now that like starting to work with them, what was it like? Like, did you struggle a little bit with accepting help? Like, I find that if you're used to going it alone for a long time, it can sometimes be difficult to accept help, to let go of things.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm a terrible editor of my own work. And so I fully leaned on Kimberly's visual eye for helping me curate how we were going to go forward. And I look back at some of how we curated initially and like, oh, good God, she let me do that. She was so nice. She should have just told me no. So she really did take my opinion and value it. And I appreciate that. But now I feel like, I don't know, everyone kinds of looks back at their work from 2 years ago with like, ugh. Some of it has to stayed the test of time, and she has now, I can see, always known which ones were going to stand the test of time. And so now that we've been working together for a while, I definitely trust her opinion more because she was able to see that right from the beginning. And I can't. I get attached to whatever it was on the day and the moment and the person. And I know the story of the reason why that drop was there, even if it's a terrible drop of whatever, you know.
Right.
We get sentimental about silly things and sometimes can't separate from things in the editing room.
Yeah, it is helpful to have an impartial, a more impartial perspective.
But also just having someone that, especially initially with estimates and establishing rates and learning how to say no to some things, and it's still hard to say no to work because someone's always going to pick up that opportunity. And when you say no to something you want to do, but you value yourself as a person and a professional and don't do it, it sucks when you're like, they did a really good job, but I know that they didn't get paid.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that is, I don't know. That never really goes away when you get like the no, because you priced it where you know you should have. And it's like, when you get the no, you're like, ugh. Like, well, I mean, I'm going to stick with my guns on this, but the temptation to be like, oh, how can we make it work?
I know. I mean, it's only changing more, but
right.
Oh, I was going to get back into cookbooks because that being kind of one of your main like specialties that you do, and we're talking about bidding. And there's a lot of like nuanced things that go into cookbooks from my understanding, that I would love for you to kind of break down some of the things that people may not understand. Because like, I think from the outside world, a lot of people are like, ooh, cookbooks, like that must be so amazing. There must be huge budgets because there's all this work that goes into it. And I mean, whether you want to validate some of that or you want to say like, that's a bit of a myth, I would love for you to kind of enlighten us.
Yeah, I think it depends on what kind of cookbook you're doing at this point. Like, I think there's a couple different ways you can do them. But a traditional book is where, you know, doing 75 to 100 recipes, you're shooting from 5 days to 10 days. And there's things you have to take into consideration. Like, you're working with a food stylist, you're working with a food style assistant. You need those two people. They're like the critical lifeblood of the book. If you don't have them, then you're in trouble, because unless you're somebody who knows how to plate your food, which has happened, I've worked on some cookbooks where the authors have that ability, but it's pretty rare. Like, a lot of people don't, and they need that food stylist to come in and really tell their story. But a lot of, I would say 5 years ago, it shifted. The publishers used to pay the photography team. And so there wasn't a lot of question about what the budgets were. Everyone knew. But now, when they needed to save money, they flipped it. So now the money goes to the author in their advance. And that is what needs to pay the crew. And so now we're suddenly getting a ton of authors that are like, why is this project $60,000? And you're like, well. And I think that, you know, for like 100 recipe book, that's actually a pretty modest estimate for not having to have like a lot of bells and whistles. And it's a sticker shock. And I think a lot of people think that you are going to make a lot of money with cookbooks, and maybe you can on the back end if you sell a lot and you work that into your deal, but you're not making it from your advance. And it, in some cases, it's a marketing tool. And I think you have to kind of switch your mindset of like, this cookbook is part of your tool belt to give yourself your platform, unless you are the rare like Martha Stewart and Ina Garten and you're getting all these sales. And I don't know how many new people are really doing that. I think it's a slow burn. It's not an overnight hit very often. So you have to explain, like, you need these teammates, you need these people, you have, are we going to spend money on a studio? Do you have a place for us to shoot? Do we have all the equipment we need? Are we making huge sets? Are we doing small sets? Are we working with people? Do they need hair and makeup? Do we have wardrobe? Like, there's this huge questionnaire of things that you kind of need. Like, we can send someone the general estimate of like, here's like an average book of this recipes for what you're asking. And then it always ends up going up or going down, depending on, like, there was from the extreme last year, I had a book where authors came to me and were supposed to shoot this book themselves, did one day of shooting and decided they couldn't shoot it and had spent part of their budget on the book and then only had X amount of money left to try and get this done. And so I was able to shoot it in my little studio that I have. We were able, because the propping was just like colored paper, like able to shoot with very minimal props. Like there's budget saving things you can do. And then I was able to work on this incredible project for the official Game of Thrones cookbook. And when they came to me about this, I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like I'm a huge geek. I love Game of Thrones. I've read the books. I've seen all of the episodes. I'm into the new show. Sign me up. And then I was like, but we're going to shoot this in a studio. I was like looking at all the other Game of Thrones content that they had done on an older book. And I was like, well, what if we did this in Croatia? My husband's family is from Croatia. And we went there for our honeymoon. And I had, you know, I'm like, here's where we could shoot this. And here's how we could do this. I never thought they were going to say yes. It was going to add another 10,000 onto the budget, which in hindsight is like not that much. But when you're not paying for the studio and you're exchanging it for travel fees, it was. And they did. So I'm like, well, go for our summer break. You can see your family. My husband's like, great. They were like, great, let's do Croatia. But our deadline is June 1st. And
oh, so no.
To Croatia by myself with my husband's father, who acted as my producer because I needed the translator.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic, though.
And we stayed with his aunt in their house. Like there was workarounds. Like I wasn't paying for a hotel the whole time because his family hosted us. So there's opportunities like that where you can make it work based on your contacts and your own resources. And I do that when I feel like I'm not taking it away from somebody else. I will say Kimberly and I like try really hard to find out what we think other people's estimates are going to be and give as close as we can to that so that it is really about the person's work and not about who is cheaper.
Right. Which is what we all hope the decision is going to be based on, but.
Well, I find it really interesting that shift in the money conversation, right? Where the money is going to the author and now you're having to educate the authors, where before when you were working with a publishing house in a traditional sense, you know, they, for the most part, knew the conversation, knew what the money was, kind of already had a pot set aside and was like, could you make it work for X dollars? And now every author is going to be like, well, can we do it for less so that I make more money?
Yeah. And that, it comes to a point where you're like, well, we can do it for less, but then you're only going to get 60 shots instead of 75. And then they ultimately have to be the one that decides like if that's okay for them.
And then there's always the hidden shots, or as I call them, or some of my friends call them, right? Like the chapter hidden shots, or like, yeah, or the front of the book or the back of the book, or
the
glossary pages.
Those things always happen, but I will say that I feel so grateful to get to do what I do, that naturally, for the most part, those are fun. Like the chapter openers, like the beautiful ingredients. If I saw that happening on set, I would be shooting that anyway. So I don't mind that there's those moments. Those are the creative moments that you get to have sometimes. And I can do them on my own, like an ingredient shot, a pantry shot, materials, all of that. Like then I'm not taking anyone else's time. I can, you know, do that while the food stylist is working on the next recipe. Or if I'm shooting in my own studio, I can do it the next day. It doesn't have to be everybody's time involved on that. So there are some workarounds, but yeah, I mean, the cookbook stuff has been really, really great. And it gave me the opportunity to make the contacts I needed to test with people to kind of build up my technical skills to do more of the advertising work. So it was great. Cause for a long time, I only shot daylight for say the first 5 years. I was only shooting maybe with, I had Kinos. I had a Kino kit. I guess I still have it somewhere.
Your flows, your keto flows. I think that's really actually fascinating, right? Because when you were assisting, was that all daylight for that one photographer you shot with or you worked with for 8 years?
Pretty much. Occasionally would bring in HMIs, which I don't know if you remember, but like such a fire hazard, like would constantly be almost lighting light diffusers on fire. Occasionally with HMIs, but otherwise daylight. Yeah.
So what made you want to push, like, what was the tipping point for you to go into learning how to shoot with strobes?
I don't know if there was any one thing. It was more like, you need to be the master of your craft and you need to understand what all this equipment does. And I would say that testing with it initially, I was like, oh, this is terrible. I don't like it. I'm not going to use it. And then it, once you find the right test and you get the right light and you figure out how it feels more like what you want to be getting across, then it feels like a tool. And even just now, I would say over the last 2 years, I've again evolved kind of how I like using strobes because I like mixing daylight with strobes. I will shoot a project that's entirely with strobes and you can do that, but I still love having inspiration from daylight. And it's been fun to figure out how to get them to work together.
Well, I think what's interesting just from saying that is I think a lot of people think they have to know how to do strobes to be a commercial photographer. And more you see that conversation online. If you follow any of like, you know, other photographers or photographer educators that are like, you know, you gotta know how to shoot strobe. Like, what if it's a dark day, blah, blah, blah. And so I love the fact that you're like, you know, hey, this is what I did for all of these years. And it's, you know, only the last 4 or 5 years that I've really kind of introduced strobes into my work and working your style into like artificial light.
Yeah. And I think that that's what it was. It's like, here's what I'm supposed to be doing versus here's what I want to be doing. Like, this is what I want to be outputting. I think that's always the dialogue that you have in your head. That's hard because it's hard not to be influenced by all of the content that's being thrown at us to really kind of figure out like, what am I drawn to? What do I want to be doing? That's why testing is so important so that you're figuring out like, why am I doing this test? Am I testing this to practice this new skill? Am I doing this test to work with this new stylist? You know, you have to figure out like your intent. You don't just like, you know, in the beginning, I was just like, give me all the people, give me all the things. I don't know what I'm doing. But now like, everything is much more intentional. My time is more precious. So,
right. Are you still, how often do you test lately?
I try and kick off the year doing them. I just did one that, if you check me on social, which was to promote like a company that I think is doing something really cool. And then I'll try and do a test that's working with new people. So this test was working with this woman who has like a meal delivery company for new moms in New York.
Oh, the Welcome Home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One. And then now I'm trying to also kind of like some of my personal stuff that I let fall to the wayside, get at least one or two of those on the books, because I realized I look back at my library and catalog of work and there's some of those that still really resonate with me. I'm like, well, if that's still resonating now, then I need to keep doing it. I don't know what for, but it's important on some capacity.
I feel like we have a really good sense of where you are. Do you like what's ahead for you, Bolo?
I know. I mean, we're trying to do our research to figure out what is happening with our world, our industry right now, because I would say during COVID, I don't know if you guys remember, but there was this period of time where everybody quit their job and got really righteous about how much they were getting paid. And they shuffled around to new jobs. And even some people like left the industry altogether, but the people that stuck around, I like figured out where they went and we stayed connected, but some of them aren't even necessarily in a position to keep hiring you. But then about a year later, all those people who got new jobs got laid off. And so then even more people left. And so then it was kind of just like rebuilding content, redoing marketing. I, you know, spent more money in marketing in the last 3 years than I've spent in my entire career, which I'm fine with doing. It was just, I didn't ever have to really do that level of official marketing and connecting in the past that I do now. And so I would say like the way that I'm trying to stay connected right now is by doing these tests and not just sending it out to the masses and closing your eyes and seeing what lands, but like being very intentional about who you're sending it to, because you know that they might be looking for that kind of work. And then I'm trying right now, I'm in meeting mode. I have 2 to 3 cookbooks potentially coming up, but they're all in pre-production right now. And then I had 2 advertising jobs that I just finished. Well, we'll see if I get retouching comments later today. retouching and getting out. So it's always like, you know, you have your shoot days, but that's only a third of what you're doing. The rest of your days are the retouching, the post, the archiving, the marketing. And thankfully it's holiday weekend. So it's going to maybe be quiet today. We'll see. We'll see. Some people are still at work.
Yeah. I'm hoping.
My retouching deadline got changed to the 1st, and I'm like, they know it's a holiday, right? It's fine. I have everything I need. I have, if they give me some more comments, but I mean, it's not like things book out 6 months ahead of time, like they used to. Things book out 3 to 4 weeks ahead of time. And you kind of just got to know your shit and be willing to jump in and be adaptable. So I have a personal shoot set up for next week, which I'm very much looking forward to, and another retouching deadline. So we'll see.
Okay, so taking this to close, I want to know if you could give, if you could pick a piece of advice to give to young Lauren coming into, you know, really the beginning of your career. What's a piece of advice you'd give? Or maybe just to someone who's like really admires the work you're doing and wants to, you know, wants to work towards that.
I think the number one thing you need to do is be adaptable, like, and be willing to communicate. I think that I've always been able to pretty much do that, but I would have maintained some earlier relationships that I was too intimidated to maintain.
Mm. Too intimidated. Why?
Because there used to be such a hierarchy in our industry that Gen Z has just like decimated. Not there anymore.
Thanks, Gen Z.
Which I know, mad respect. You guys have a lot of chutzpah that I did not have. you like sat in your corner and you kept your eyes focused and you stayed in your corner. And it's not like I would have been on set and like been chatting up the creative director, which has happened to me with some of my assistants now. But I think I just wouldn't have been so afraid to reach out to some of those top tier advertising people right from the get go. Like I kind of did, but then I was like, oh, they didn't write me back, so they're not interested. Now it would have been like, here's a phone call, here's some work, like let's get this going. Instead of, yeah, that's
good advice. I love that. Where can people follow along and keep up with all the exciting things you're doing?
Well, Big Leo does a much better job of updating your website than I do, so please look at that first. Thanks, Kimberly. And my Instagram is Lauren Vola, so you can follow me there.
Awesome. And we'll make sure to link to all the things in the show notes. Lauren, thank you so much for being on with us today. This was such a treat. Such a treat.
Thanks again for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. We would like to thank our team, edit and mix production by Sterling Coates, marketing and social media support from Laura Hillstrom and Jen Bellina, and booking and production support by Maren Rossman and Tracy Tarek.
We would also like to shout out to our founders, Tracy Tarek and Mary Dell, and the rest of our Focus on Women board and volunteers. Find out more about our organization and how you can get involved at focusonwomen.org.